What's up, Rebels? Hey, it's Nate Houseman. I'm your intrepid guide to the 21st century, and we're going to look at some news stories and knowledge and resources to help you navigate what's going on here. Today, we're going to look at the news of the market crash in stocks and Bitcoin. We're going to look at some entertainment news concerning Grand Theft Auto, the movie industry, and the Pussycat Dolls. We're going to look at Japan fighting back against Western encroachment, and we're going to wrap it up with Freedom Day in the UK. So if you find this content valuable, please give it a thumbs up on whatever platform you're watching it on. Hit the subscribe button and share it with your friends and family and everyone you care about. And before we get started, I'm going to tell you ways you can support my program. You can go to my website, natehouseman.net. Click the shop button and buy some merchandise. I have an ebook titled Be True Cut Through Quarantine Edition, and it explains to you how to set up your own online business and market it. You can download the PDF when you go to my website. I have a few affiliate links. There's Acre Gold, and it's more important than ever that we put our money into assets like gold, silver, cryptocurrency, real estate. And the reason for that is the whole monetary system we're living in right now is based on debt, and that's how the powers of be keep us on their leash. So we can liberate ourselves by building true wealth through assets. There's Acre Gold, and there's also iTrust Capital, where you can build your retirement plan on precious metals and cryptocurrency. And when you need to, you can also get your independence by having an online business, and you can host your business on DreamHost, a certain, a proven free speech platform. When you build your website, you do it on WordPress, and you can use my preferred WordPress theme, Divi, through Elegant Themes. They have a great drag and drop builder and dozens of pre-made layouts for you to build your website with. And if you need any help with your website, click on the link to Fiverr. You can find a freelancer, like a web designer. You can find someone to promote your business. There's like so many gigs out there, and you might be inspired to start your own. So click on any of these affiliate links. I'll get a commission, and that supports the program. And let's get to it. Starting with the market. This is from yesterday. Dow futures jumped more than 200 points after the Dow suffers worst day since October. And they're saying it's because of the Delta variant of the beer bug. Stock futures jumped in the early morning trading on Tuesday after concerns about the spread of COVID-19's Delta variant sent investors dumping equities, especially those directly affected by pandemic restrictions. So what that really means is any companies that are, affected by government lockdowns, those are probably the stocks that are hurting. Futures on the Dow Jones Industrial Average were up 263 points. S&P 500 futures and NASDAQ 100 futures both traded mildly higher. Wall Street suffered a sharp sell-off during regular trading hours as investors feared that the fast-spreading Delta coronavirus variant could hinder economic recovery. The blue chip Dow tumbled more than 700 points to post its worst day since October, while the S&P 500 fell 1.6% and the NASDAQ composite dropped about 1.1%. Fear of stagflation will be a major concern for investors if a resurgence in COVID infections causes economies to slow while consumer prices continue to an upward trajectory, said Peter Essell, head of investment management at Commonwealth Financial Network. New COVID cases are rebounding in the U.S. as the Delta variant spreads, largely among the unvaccinated. If you say so, CNBC, the U.S. is averaging about 26,000 daily cases in the last 7 days, more than double the average from a month ago, according to CDC data. Shares that are directly tied to a successful reopening, such as airlines and cruise line operators, bore the brunt of the sell-off, and those are the companies that are most tightly regulated by the government. Carnival and Norwegian Cruise Line dropped more than 5% each, while Royal Caribbean fell 4.4%, Shares of United Airlines dropped 5.5%. Even after Monday's drop, the S&P 500 is just below 3.1% below, is just 3.1% below its record hit last week. Additionally, while the equity benchmark dipped below its 50-day moving average during Monday's rout, it ultimately closed above that key technical level, offering some hope to investors looking for a rebound. Many of the cyclical companies are selling off on fears that COVID will stop the recovery in its tracks. Translation, fears that the government will stop recovery in its tracks. We don't believe that that's the case, and we are willing to let the sell-off run its course and buy the dip on the belief that the economy will fully recover and return to its prior growth trajectory, bringing the most of the cyclical companies in the airline, travel, and leisure industries along with it. So, IBM shares jumped 3% in extended trading Monday after the enterprise technology and service provider reported second quarter results that topped expectations. All right. I just see this as a lot of FUD. A lot of these global, worldwide corporations, they are, tied to the hip with governments. And that's been established. And we're learning that that's becoming more and more obvious every day. So whether people are really, supporting these corporations or not, or just the big money investing whales, that's the question. Moving on to Bitcoin. Bitcoin crashes below 30K, but on-chain data suggests accumulation is brewing. Despite the Bitcoin market dipping below $30,000, on-chain data suggests accumulation may be underway, as $1 billion worth of Bitcoin leaves exchanges each month. So people are taking their cryptocurrency off exchanges and probably putting it in their wallets, which I said you probably should do yesterday. Yesterday I talked about, I mentioned Crypto Casey's channel, and she posted a three-part series where she thinks the cryptocurrency market is due for some temporary, shakeups because of the traditional financial markets and shenanigans with the cryptocurrency called Tether. And the smart thing to do is don't necessarily sell your crypto, just take it off the exchanges and put it in a wallet, like a digital wallet or a physical wallet, and just hang on to it. Don't let anyone manipulate the market for you. Despite Bitcoin crashing below 30,000 for the first time in 1 month, on-chain metrics suggest whales may be steadily accumulating Bitcoin. According to Glassnode's July 19th, the week on-chain report, the Bitcoin reserves of centralized exchanges have continued to evaporate despite the recently sustained bearish momentum, with the average of 36,000 Bitcoin, worth roughly $1 billion, being withdrawn from the exchanges monthly. Glassnode infers the shrinking Bitcoin reserves on exchanges as indicating large investors moving the Bitcoin into secure storage, rather than leaving their coins on exchanges in preparation for selling. And the saying goes, not your keys, not your crypto. You want, when your Bitcoin is on exchanges like Coinbase or Uphold or Crypto.com, you don't really have control of it. In order to really own your crypto, you got to move it into a wallet with keys. So that's basically what they're saying here. Glassnode also identified the recent increase in the number of entities hodling Bitcoin since May, increasing from roughly 250,000 to nearly 300,000 today. Glassnode describes an entity as a unique on-chain cluster of associated addresses. The on-chain analytics provider noted that the number of sending entities, the unique address clusters associated with selling, has fallen by roughly one-third from 150,000 to 100,000, while receiving entities, addresses linked to accumulation or holding, have increased by roughly 20%. Despite emphasizing signals suggesting accumulation, Glassnode noted heavily divided market sentiment, predicting extreme volatility may be imminent for the markets. It added that miners are now also in accumulation mode, despite expenses incurred in the Great Migration in the wake of China's mining crackdown. The miner net position changes metric The miner net position change metric indicates more than 3,300 Bitcoin per month is currently being accumulated. Lots of inside baseball there, but China's cracking down on Bitcoin mining, and they're doing that because of the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, and all the miners in China are going where there's more freedom. All right. Now, I mentioned central banks, and they are a large reason why a lot of people don't stand up to fight the power much, because we're pretty much living in debt. It's not just, you know, the national debt of your country. You're also on the hook with your mortgage or your landlord's mortgage or your car payments or your monthly bills. The fiat currency is really, it's not really any asset. It's actually a marker of debt. So, and that's the way the central banks like it. So in this article by CoinDesk, it's an opinion piece by Nick Carter. It talks about stable coins, but it kind of talks about how way back in American history before the Civil War, banks used to not really deal in fiat currency. They used to deal in gold and silver. And we're going to look at why the central bank's propaganda is so off base. Why central bankers invoke free banking to attack stablecoins. If you're going to warn people about stablecoins by citing 19th century history, you should at least include the full record, says our columnist, Nick Carter. If you pay attention to the central bank agitprop, you may have noticed an interesting trend. Central bankers are increasingly fond of making references to monetary history, specifically the pre-Civil War period in the United States. That was when the U.S. entered a monetary era known as free banking. As it's characterized today, it was a rollicking time, rife with bank failures and monetary instability, in which banknotes traded at a discount to par, reflecting the creditworthiness of the bank. As the central bankers tell it, if you were to take a Tennessee banknote to New York, for instance, your money might not have been accepted at par. From the 1830s to the 1860s, the vast majority of banknotes were issued privately by banks, mostly regulated by individual states. So, really, a banknote back then was just a paper certificate saying that you owned a certain amount of gold and it was being held in that bank. So, and that's what dollar bills used to be up until 1971, when the dollar was taken off the gold standard. A dollar just meant that you owned a certain amount of gold in Fort Knox. Our monetary elite has become fixated on this period recently. In May, Federal Reserve Governor Lael Brainard denounced antebellum banking in a speech exploring the creation of central bank digital currencies. Indeed, the period in the 19th century where there was active competition among issuers of private paper banknotes in the United States is now notorious for inefficiency, fraud, and instability in the payment system. It led to the need for a uniform form of money backed by the national government. Back in 2018, the president of the St. Louis Fed, James Bullard, also issued his own history-inspired critique of cryptocurrency, saying, "Cryptocurrencies are creating drift toward a non-uniform currency in the United States, a state of affairs that has existed historically, but was disliked and eventually replaced." In a hearing on digital currency last month, U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren repeated similar talking points, comparing stablecoins to wildcat notes from the 19th century. And just last week, Jeffrey Zhang, an attorney at the Federal Reserve, and Gary Gordon, a professor at Yale, published a paper titled "Taming Wildcat Stablecoins," in which they pejoratively compare stablecoins today to the banking context of the 19th century, which they refer to as free banking. The paper concludes that privately issued money, whether free banking or stablecoin-based, cannot work, and that only a sovereign can supply good money. The paper was commended by none other than the High Prince of Fiat, Paul Krugman, who used it as an opportunity to condemn stablecoins. And in this tweet, Paul Krugman says, "This, by Gordon and Zhang, is very good. Stablecoins are just a modern version of free banking, in which private banks issued their own notes, supposedly backed by specie. That system was crisis-ridden, and the same will be true of true, no, papers, okay." That's a link to some article. In all these cases, attacks on free banking, the notion of permitting banks to operate largely outside the confines of state regulation, are rhetorically employed to undermine stablecoins. Stablecoins come in many forms, but primarily exist as tokenized IOUs for commercial bank dollars that circulate on public blockchains, allowing settlement in dollars or other sovereign currency terms. They trade at par because they're convertible for underlying dollars in commercial banks, or sold to someone who is willing to undertake that conversion. Because stablecoins trade on public blockchains and facilitate the global exchange of value across a network of exchanges and wallets, the issuers, for the most part, aren't regulated as banks. These comparisons to laissez-faire banking naturally emerge. So do stablecoins constitute a reprisal of free banking? And if so, is this a problem? On the first question, the author says, I would answer in the affirmative. Free banks rely on gold as reserves, whereas stablecoins are mostly issued against commercial bank dollars. Larry White points out other things where there are no analogies in terms to the liabilities between notes issued by free banks and the stablecoins of today. But by and large, the comparisons are quite apt. So much so that we wrote a white paper in summer 2020 pointing out that stablecoins and their issuers, oftentimes exchanges, represent a potentially technologically enabled return to a free banking era. As we say in the piece, lessons can be taken from the history of prior banking epochs when private entities took responsibility for issuing money, effectively outside of state control. So on this point, we very much agree with the comparison between free banks and stablecoins proffered by Brainerd, Zhang, and Gordon. However, their emphasis solely on the U.S. instance of free banking is wrong-headed. As economists George Selgin and Larry White have spent virtually their entire careers pointing out, and we echo in our crypto dollar piece, the American antebellum episode did not constitute genuine laissez-faire banking. Banks in that period were forced to hold risky state government bonds and were restricted from engaging in branching, meaning they couldn't establish branches nationwide. This inhibited them from geographically diversifying their depositor base and from having free choice in their asset portfolio. It's no wonder that bank failures were common. So, blame it on the government. Neither of these peculiarly U.S.-based restrictions were present in genuine free banking episodes, such as Canada. There's also Scotland's successful case study, chronicled by the aforementioned Selgin and White, alongside Krosner and Dowd. The repeated omission of successful historical instances of free banking, such as Scotland, Canada, Sweden, and Switzerland, in which bank failures were uncommon, notes were mutually accepted by rival banks and traded at par, appears strategic. For analyses that do consider the fuller historical record, see Selgin and White's comparison of free banking and contemporary stablecoins. So why are the central bankers so keen to characterize the private issuance of money as inherently unstable? Because they are central banks. They are control freaks. Because they're deeply conflicted, says the author. They rely on these myths to sell us their proposed solution in the form of CBDCs, central bank digital currencies. It's no coincidence that the anti-stablecoin contingent is generally fond of CBDCs and believes the state should not only control the issuance of money, but also have the power to determine which transactions are valid. We do not have to speculate on this front. If you listen to central bankers, they invariably de-emphasize privacy in transactions and mention the necessary imposition of controls and inhibiting activities that the government claims are illicit. This is sometimes euphemized as balancing an individual's right to privacy with the public's interest in the enforcement of AML-CFT regulations. So balancing the individual's rights against the public interest. Despite the fact that physical cash has no inbuilt anti-money laundering combating the financing of terrorism controls, I have yet to come across a central banker proposing a CBDC project with the precise and same qualities of privacy, transactional freedom as physical cash. And as I mentioned, after the Colonial Pipeline attack and also after the meatpacking attack, cyber attack, cyber criminals, they demanded their ransom in Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a stupid way to demand a ransom because of the public ledger system. You can see every single transaction that occurs on Bitcoin on the ledger. So if you see a large amount in certain, amount of Bitcoin going to a certain address, you know where it went. So, and that's what the central banks don't want to talk about. The debate is fundamentally about the state's role in society. CBDCs promise to strip some of the issuing power of money away from the commercial bank sector, which exists as a public-private partnership, and restore it to the central government. This would naturally grant governments extremely powerful tools for surveillance, societal control, and would empower central bankers with granular tools to affect the money supply. In a country where politicization of banking is an established doctrine, CBDCs would represent a colossal victory for those trying to concentrate power in state hands. Bingo! Can say it better than myself. Thus, the reason historical episodes with private monetary issuance and administration are so frequently a target is because they stand in the way of attacks on stablecoins and cryptocurrency in general. The success of stablecoins and the intended stagnation of CBDC projects is embarrassing to central bankers and policymakers. Stablecoins offer everything that CBDCs hope to achieve, but in a completely bottom-up, free market way. Now, this article keeps going. I'm going to read the whole thing because it's pretty good. If economists can prove that episodes of free and unrestricted banking were failures and led to massive consumer losses, that might prove that similar latter-day systems are a bad idea too. Unfortunately for them, not only is their historical account flawed, but so is their present-day assessment of stablecoins. Far from being inherently flawed or unstable, stablecoins are an overwhelming success today. I don't know about Tether, but maybe other cryptocurrencies. The free market has allocated over $110 billion in deposits to these projects, even though they have only really existed in production for 7 years or so. Stablecoins collectively today settle anywhere between 10 and 20 billion on a given day, trading with extremely tight spreads. Gordon and Zhang object that stablecoin recipients will not accept those tokens at par because the no questions asked principle is violated due to the lack of confidence in the issuer and no government backing. Without NQA, they insist, the community had no money. Stablecoins that do not satisfy this principle also will not be able to serve as money in transactions. But their analysis is off base both historically and in the present day. Private banknotes work just fine. In Scotland, between 1716 and 1844. Today, stablecoins have been embraced and indeed accepted at par by billions of individuals and firms, thanks to the presence of convertibility. Indeed, our venture fund, alongside many of our industry colleagues, today prefers to settle investments in stablecoin format because they operate 24/7, offer strong finality, and do not face the massive headaches involved in sending wires abroad. And this is also why Bitcoin is helping El Salvador a lot, because it's not, you know, people are able to, immigrants in the U.S. are able to send their money to relatives in El Salvador electronically through Bitcoin. They don't have to go through the wire transfers like Western Union. For globally distributed teams, stablecoins make far more sense than trying to tackle transfers to dozens of different countries via extractive intermediaries and the Byzantine correspondent banking system. On this topic, the free market has already outmatched central banks. Encouragingly, some central bankers, like Fed Vice Chair Randall Quarles, have understood the merits of stablecoins and have not dismissed them out of hand. Nevertheless, it's clear now that nothing in money or finance is deemed outside the purview of Washington and the New York Fed. The key question is, once they get a hold of them and regulate them appropriately, how will they do? As for the consumer benefit of private versus public money, one only has to consider what happened after the free banking episode and the U.S. monetary issuance was centralized in the hands of the state, which promptly inflated away everyone's savings during the Civil War. Curiously, the central bankers touting the benefits of public money omit that part of the story. Boom! Love that. And this article is on CoinDesk, titled Why Central Bankers Invoke Free Banking to Attack Stablecoins. And I will not say all stablecoins are like this. You know, Tether has huge problems, and if you want to understand that, go check out CryptoCasey's videos. But cryptocurrency in general, it's sound money. It's like Bitcoin is essentially digital gold. You know, it's secured by cryptographic, coding, and it's distributed all over the world on the blockchain. So no single person or organization controls it. And that's why the central banks hate it so much. Moving on, let's talk about some entertainment news. Starting with the video game world. This is from a few days ago. Take-Two issuing more DMC takedowns for Grand Theft Auto mods. Grand Theft Auto, that legendary series where you get to play as a thug or criminal mastermind in an open-world environment. And I never really saw the appeal of it except for the whole open-world system. It seems Take-Two Interactive isn't too happy with people modding or reverse-engineering GTA. A DMCA takedown, which is basically it involves copyrights, has been issued against a number of projects, including GTA Underground, which is no longer available to download. Thanks, PC Gamer. The publisher has been on a roll lately, issuing takedowns on a number of GTA fan projects. GTA Underground is an ambitious project that combines the maps of San Andreas, Liberty City, Vice City, Manhunt, Manhunt 2, and Bully into one gigantic landscape. These are all different GTA, games, plus the Take-Two game Bully. It also includes gang warfare, additional vehicles, and weapons. The mod is currently unavailable on mod database, and the developer has also issued a statement on GTA forums, along with others who have been discussing the issue. This morning, GTA Underground was taken off ModDB due to a DMC takedown notice that was presented on behalf of Take-Two Interactive, said developer DCluin. We are currently trying to look for a solution, and our release plans are put to rest for the time being. We will continue updating you as the situation progresses. This comes after Take-Two issued a DMC takedown against GTA 3 and GTA Vice City reverse engineering project. Fortunately for the developers, the project was able to resume after a counterclaim was filed. Dubbed RE3 and REVC, the project introduces new features and improvements to the game. Numerous bugs have been fixed, and a debug menu and camera were included. Additionally, the games are now instantly compatible with current controllers and also have no loading screens between islands. Widescreen support with a scaled HUD heads-up display and improved visuals were among the other changes. Unlike the original Grand Theft Auto 3, RE3 even contains a map of Liberty City in the pause menu. Take-Two still hasn't come out with a statement regarding these takedowns, leaving modders confused whether they should continue their projects or wait it out until things become clearer. Perhaps this is an indicator of a planned GTA 3 or Vice City remaster, but that's only a guess as of now. For now, Take-Two's internal developer Rockstar seems solely focused on Grand Theft Auto Online, with the game receiving constant updates and expansions. The latest one will give certain vehicles a speed boost and enhanced version of the game arrives on next-gen consoles. So, as I understand it, mods for games, they're not really, most of them are not paid mods. The developers don't make any money. They just create these out of just for fun, and they want to enhance the game experience for everyone. And for Take-Two to issue all these copyright strikes against these mods, I think that probably only applies if they're trying to make money off of Grand Theft Auto code. If they're not making money, that's kind of a murky area. So this is probably an issue of a corporation trying to control their own, intellectual property. But I don't know. Grand Theft GTA is such a huge, IP. They say GTA Online is like the single most profitable piece of entertainment in world history. And it just seems so, I'm trying to think of a word. Just so thug to be part of this world. It's like, what can I say? Moving on to some more corporate entertainment shenanigans. Cannes Film Festival 2021 market and fest takeaways. Post-pandemic theatrical still anemic, streamer dollars a boon to content creators and a curse for international distributors. This is from Deadline. Basically, I think looking at the Cannes Film Festival, they're taking note that streaming is killing the theater industry and totally changing how movies and entertainment is, how the business is run. The article starts, so how to grade the 2021 Cannes Film Festival and especially the film marketplace? It'd be too simple to describe it as a solid, if unspectacular, affair when considering the pre-sales business done virtually in the weeks leading up to the festival and a few small deals for art house films that premiered on the Riviera. A pandemic rebound will be measured in increments, but the most notable part of 2021 Cannes might well be the collective rallying cry elicited from buyers, sellers, and stars, and filmmakers who routinely were moved to tears at the Palais premieres, simply because of the feeling that getting back to what was stolen from them by the COVID shutdown. It would be a mistake to talk about the market and the festival contextualized by normalcy, said Film Nation's Glenn Basner, who with the CAA Media Finance led the charge on three big packages in the virtual market that preceded Cannes and also was there for the Palais premiere of the Sean Baker-directed Red Rocket. Not a very well-written sentence. That didn't roll off the tongue very easily. It's not normal. My experience was, I have never been to a Cannes where everyone or everybody was talking about the movies that were screening there. There was such joy and such a diverse and exciting group of films. That to me was so fantastic, not to have to worry about 8,000 different deals that I may be working on in the market alongside the festival, and said, really just be present with cinema and Cannes, which is such a special place to premiere movies. I thought that was glorious. The market last week was about the movies screening in the festival and being sold, he said. There were lots of deals and a lot of movies. We saw Mubi become an aggressive buyer of art house movies. Sony Pictures Classics bought movies, and so did Neon, and some others. For art house cinema that screened in Cannes, it was really brisk, though that's a different ballgame than the traditional Cannes market that was done a couple weeks ago. Deals on the ground were modest. The most hotly fought over Cannes darling Scandinavian film, The Worst Person in the World, saw Neon battling A24, IFC, and Sony Pictures Classics, and the deal was only around $750,000 for U.S. rights. MGM bought Sean Penn's Flag Day for an undisclosed number. Larger sums were paid for pre-sale packages that included the Anton Broker deal with STX committing around $75 million for world rights to the Gerard Butler sequel Greenland Migration. Okay, there's a lot of deals being made here. And I think the point of this is filmmakers, they pretty much use Cannes as a marketplace to sell their projects to different studios and distributors to basically sell to show in the theaters. Neon distributor, Palme d'Or winner, Titan, directed by Julia Ducournau, was most voracious at the festival out of North America, but none was busier than European art house streamer distributor Mubi, which went on a remarkable tear. So, just talking about the big winners there. But there was so many more intangible benefits to this Cannes, and regular attendees won't soon forget it. Even 6 weeks ago, it was an open question whether Thierry Frémaux, I just don't know how to pronounce French names here, whether Thierry Frémaux would be able to hold an in-person gathering because of a lag of COVID vaccinations there and in other countries, and the lagging progress toward global herd immunity. The virtual market was done because it was clear that many international Cannes regulars from the UK, Latin America, and Asia likely would not be able to come, no matter what. Reports had first-ring reviewers of major publications like New York Times skipping the festival. As it turned out, organizers smartly set up COVID testing centers that were so efficient, all one had to do was make an appointment, show up, and wait about 5 minutes for a technician to send a swab up a nostril far enough upward that one could swear they felt their brain poked. Yeah, I've had that done. Not fun. Trying to find the main point of this article. It's basically just how the Cannes Film Festival was open pretty much only to Europeans, and how it was a marketplace for movies. After the recovery of the global independent market, meeting for the first time was a step forward, but the business will take time to recover and return to where it was before COVID shut down the business for a year. There are lingering problems for independent content creators unable to secure completion bonds because issuers won't cover COVID stoppages, for instance. But Cannes was an important step forward toward some semblance of normalcy. AGC Studios Chairman CEO Stuart Ford didn't come with a film he needed to sell, nor did Lionsgate or Sierra Affinity and some other big companies. AGC has the Roland Emmerich-directed, indie-financed Moonfall in the can, and the Brad Peyton-directed Universe's Most Wanted and several other big films in the works. He came specifically to assess the health of the business and came away optimistic. He believes that the appetite for big commercial fare is robust, but cautions that recovery of the theatrical business is only going to come in time. The theatrical releasing business is going to continue to be very challenging, at a minimum, for the remainder of this year internationally and possibly well beyond that, depending on what happens with the pandemic, Ford told Deadline. That was clear with nearly every distributor I spoke to. On the plus side, it was also very clear to me there was significant buying power still out there amongst international distributors, not least because of the sheer infusion of capital into the local marketplaces for both the global and local streaming platforms. Streaming platforms, here we go. Whether that be by bypassing theatrical release and going straight to the streamers or making TV or movies for the streamers. There is a lot of money flowing internationally, and that augurs well for the independent business going forward and brings me to a third conclusion. Going forward, it's going to be about the big movies. The appetite for these kinds of films is as strong as I've ever seen it. The money available amongst buyers and the premium they're willing to pay is significant, because there are films that can compete in the current and future landscape. International companies are willing to prioritize those acquisitions, and there's significant capital available in the local marketplaces. The appetite for the international distributors for programmers or limited theatrical films is going to be very limited. What they want are big, noisy films that can compete with studios and streamers for eyeballs. The prognosis is pretty healthy, therefore, for the top end of the independent marketplace. And I'm just looking here. It looks like probably theaters are going to struggle to find films other than the big budget Hollywood blockbusters. For independent films, like the ones that they show in Cannes, for the longest time they needed, you know, distributors from the big studios, judging from this article. But they might have better luck selling to streamers like Netflix or, you know, these all these other streaming companies like Disney Plus and HBO Max. Yeah, they're tied to like the big studios like Warner Brothers, Disney, Universal, Paramount. For independent films, their best bet is probably either Netflix or finding their own independent distribution channel. So we're gonna see how that goes. As for what I always watch, you know, hey, I'm on YouTube, I'm on Odyssey, I'm on podcasts. I watch YouTube almost exclusively anymore on my TV. Sometimes I watch old Super Sentai episodes on Amazon, and I barely touch Netflix because none of the movies I want to see are on there. So it's like, I feel like, you know, For independent content to really get out there, they're gonna have to like find a way to monetize their own movies and put it on a marketplace that's totally independent of the current corporate structure, YouTube notwithstanding. So that's just another chapter in 21st century entertainment. Moving on with entertainment. And something very dire. Former Pussycat Doll claims band was a prostitution ring. Now, this is not recent news. This is from October of 2017. Yesterday, I mentioned the Britney Spears case and how someone on Trump's legal team tweeted that Britney Spears is much more important than we realize, and she's going to red pill us so hard. I think what's now that all eyes are on Britney Spears and how her family has basically used her and controlled her through conservatorship abuse, it's going to expose probably a whole lot more abuse in the entertainment industry. This has been going on for probably many years, and we're going to see that Me Too was only the beginning. Hollywood entertainment treat women like crap. All right, Kaia Jones claims the Pussycat Dolls were operated as a prostitution ring during her time in the group. The 33-year-old star joined the girl band as a teenager in 2003 and has now claimed entertainment executives took advantage of members, alleging they were all abused and had pressure put on them to sleep with whoever they say. In a series of tweets, Jones wrote, "They tried to silence us, made us stronger, tried to drug us, but we were wide awake. Tried to blacklist us, but fans followed. We weren't kids anymore. The children you messed with that survived the abuse, we are adults now. Are you ready, old ones, to fight? Because you all are looking mighty old. My truth, I wasn't in a girl group. I was in a prostitution ring. Oh, and we happened to sing and be famous. Well, everyone who owned us made the money. How bad was it? People ask. Bad enough that I walked away from my dreams, bandmates, and a $13 million record deal. We knew we were going to number one. I want the den mother from hell to confess why another one of her girl group girls committed suicide. Tell the public how you mentally broke us. To be part of the team, you must be a team player, meaning sleep with whoever they say. If you don't, they have nothing on you to leverage. Yes, I said leverage, meaning after they turn you out or get you hooked on drugs, they use it against you. Correct, victimizing the victim again. That's why I have so much respect for our military. I've been through war, but my scars you can't see. The last real war is honest. Jones also claimed she had been told that if she spoke out, she would end up dead and her career would be ruined, and admitted that she kept a journal during this time. She wrote, "Why don't we report it? Because we were all abused. I personally have been warned if I tell, I will, end up dead or no more career. I will, killing you or killing your soul, what's the difference? You do it for them, but teenagers go to jail for less. Well, Hollywood. I wonder if any other victims kept a journal like I did. Oh, yes, I kept a journal with timelines." Jones, who quit the Pussycat Dolls in 2005, claimed the band members were paid $500 a week and were abused and used. She tweeted, "Abuse is abuse. Doesn't matter if it's mental, physical, or emotional. Music industry needs a cleansing. I finally feel the weight I've held in my heart lifted and mending. It's too hard to hold lies in for people who broke me. No more." And lots of more tweets. She told The Blast that Jones is clearly looking for her 50 minutes, or who said this? Following Jones' comments, Pussycat Dolls founder Robin Anton has hit back at the allegations, claiming they are nothing more than disgusting, ridiculous lies. She told The Blast that Jones is clearly looking for her 15 minutes, and insisted the singer was only on trial and never actually did an official me was never actually an official member of the group, which Nicole Scherzinger and Melanie Thornton joined in 2003 alongside Carmen Bishar, Ashley Roberts, Jessica Suda, and Kimberly Wyatt. Robin also insisted that the nasty of Jones to bring up the 2014 suicide of former GRL member Simone Battle, who was initially part of the Pussycat Dolls' new lineup in 2012, before it was revealed the band's members would be part of a next generation group called GRL. So, do we believe this? Is it believable? This next article talks about Pussycat Dolls deny prostitution claims. This is also from the same day. Pussycat Dolls have issued a joint statement denying allegations that the pop group was a prostitution ring. The hard part about I don't want to say the word, but sexual abuse is that it's so hard to prove. It's such a personal, horror. It amounts to a he said, she said, and usually in the criminal justice system, the defendant is always considered innocent until proven guilty. So the burden is on the victim to prove the abuser really abused it. And that's how this abuse keeps, existing in entertainment. You hear these horrible stories like, Corey Feldman and Corey Haim. Like Corey Feldman came out with the documentary a few years ago. Heard about Me Too, obviously, and Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey. But the Me Too movement went off the rails when they went after, innocent people. And I think now with out in this year when things are suddenly coming out in the open with like when it comes to like the economy and government corruption, this might be the next, big revelation. How sexual abuse is used as a form of leverage against powerful people. There's the rumor that, well, with the whole Jeffrey Epstein, saga. If someone got caught with underage girls on his island, Jeffrey Epstein owned you. He made his money through blackmail, and you could probably control a lot of powerful government officials or corporate executives through that sort of thing. It's Britney Spears is probably gonna red pill a lot of us so hard. So, some more entertainment nonsense. Dungeons and Dragons Strixhaven campaign has mechanics for what a hot mess college life can be. And this is not real Dungeons and Dragons. I was watching Clownfish TV the other night, and Neon, who is usually such a rock, he flew off the handle when he read the story. He grew up on Dungeons and Dragons, and its current owners, Wizards of the Coast, who also own Magic the Gathering, they ruined the game for a lot of old time fans. I never got into Dungeons and Dragons, but this is just another, issue of corporate entertainment corrupting things that, make us happy. When Dungeons and Dragons campaign books based on the world of Magic the Gathering, Wizards of the Coast designers have to come up with ways to make existing mechanics and characters from the collectible card game fit into an entirely different set of established rules. That was especially challenging for the team behind the upcoming crossover book, Strixhaven, A Curriculum of Chaos, because they were also looking for a way to translate the college experience. And they're trying to bring magic school to Dungeons and Dragons, which was never about magical school. They're trying, Harry Potter did it right, but that's not what D&D is. So, I don't know if I'll read the whole article, but this is about to go over like a lead balloon, I'm sure. There is some sort of weird movement in Western entertainment that is, twisting beloved franchises for people who grew up in like the 70s, 80s, 90s. And I kind of my unified theory when it comes to the downfall of Western entertainment is with the internet, so many creators with real genuine talent and genuine integrity, they're going independent. They're creating their own things, like they're making comic books and crowdfunding them on Kickstarter or Indiegogo, and they're earning six figures on their projects where if they were, drawing comics for DC or Marvel, they barely make a living wage. So, and that leaves all the hacks and bootlickers and sociopaths to work in the corporate entertainment world. So, that's the case in Western entertainment. Now, what's happening in Japan, because a big part of this episode is Japan fighting back. This is from Bounding Into Comics. JC staff producer Atsushi Fujishiro reveals that rather than changing things for foreigners, anime studio chooses to simply carry on with our style. JC staff producer Atsushi Fujishiro has revealed that rather than changing things for foreigners, the seasoned anime studio behind such popular anime adaptations as Food Wars, Shokugeki no Soma, and Prison School instead actively chooses to simply carry on with our style. And I think their fans in the Western world are going to appreciate that, because so many cartoons and Western comics are just going down the drain. Everyone's reading manga because the creators in Japan, they're making actual good content. No one wants them to change. Fujishiro, whose personal producer credits include the second season of One Punch Man and Food Wars Shokugeki no Soma, The Fifth Plate, shared his thoughts on the general sentiments towards overseas fans while speaking with popular anime YouTuber Gigguk during the latter's recent visit to the JC staff studio building. And here's that interview on Bandit Comics page. Sharing his observation that it feels like recently the overseas fan has a bigger voice in Japan, Gege proceeded to ask Fujishiro, if you take overseas fans into account at all while making a product, or is that something you don't consider at all? To which the producer asserted, I don't think overseas fans have caused big changes in our style. When I think about it, the Japanese style of animation is well received overseas. That is very, very true. I love anime. A lot of people love anime. He says, Fujishiro. So rather than changing things for foreigners, we simply carry on with our style. Fujishiro concluded his response to Gigguk's question by noting, while we are aware of overseas fans, we generally don't make changes for their sake. So, and I don't think overseas fans would have it any other way, because the entertainment in their own countries is circling the drain. Now Japan is also really worked up about the Tokyo Olympics. This is from Zero Hedge. Tokyo Olympics face widespread opposition. With the Tokyo Olympics just 4 days away, probably 3 days now because this article's a day old, now would normally be the time for anticipation to build, for the Olympics spark to spread from the host country all over the world, and for athletes to wrap up years of preparation. This year, though, as statistics Felix Richard notes, with COVID-19 still lurking, things are sadly different. The 2020 Summer Olympics, postponed to 2021 due to the pandemic, are widely met with a strange mix of indifference and dismissal. Amid fears of rising case numbers and aggressive virus variants, the Japanese people are firmly against the Tokyo Games. While the global public has trouble getting excited for yet another crowdless event, seemingly prioritizing commercial interests over public health concerns. According to an Ipsos survey, an average of 53% of respondents across the 28 countries in which the poll was conducted are opposed to holding the games this year, with Japanese opposition particularly strong at 78%. And the only country that really opposes it more is South Korea, according to this graph. With athletes pulling out of the Olympics due to COVID infections, and others reportedly testing positive after arriving at the Olympic Village, doubts over the safety of the mega event continue to mount. According to Asahi Shimbun poll, 68% of Japanese respondents doubt that the games can be held safe and secure, a promise repeatedly made by Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga in the IOC. And I think sports in general... Shut up. I think sports in general are really on the way out. They become so politicized, and after, COVID, after the shutdowns, people just got out of the habit of watching sports. I mean, it's great to, competition is a great thing. It's, sports can be like war by another means, as, way of replacing that. But people are treating it, are kind of realizing it's the bread and circuses. It's the distraction from real issues. So, in the Olympics, they've actually had a lot of black eyes for the last several decades. The Olympics are terrible for the host city. There's a lot of, activity during the Olympics. But when everyone's gone, there are these huge venues, and no one uses them. So, I feel like a lot of people are over sports. And a lot of people are over the COVID lockdowns. We're going to wrap up with this article from the Evening Standard in the UK. Anti-lockdown protesters gather in Westminster on Freedom Day. Protesters chanted, "Shame on police," and "Arrest Boris Johnson," as they gathered in Parliament Square on Monday. Police are responding to an anti-lockdown protest in Westminster, which saw demonstrators block a road and force traffic to a standstill on so-called Freedom Day. Protesters held signs and chanted freedom as they gathered in Parliament Square on Monday, and after all remaining coronavirus restrictions were lifted in England, including an end to social distancing rules. The demonstration moved from Parliament Square to spread onto the road and up the gates to the Palace of Westminster, leading Metropolitan Police officers to urge protesters to move out of the road. And the Metro Police events tweeted, "We're responding to a demonstration in Parliament Square this afternoon. A group have blocked the road, which is causing traffic disruption. Officers are on the scene, speaking with those taking part in the protest and looking to ease congestion as soon as possible. An officer was seen to put a lock on a gate at the entrance to Parliament, while those outside held signs with anti-vaccination and anti-police messages, with some chanting, 'Shame on police,' and 'Arrest Boris Johnson.'" The Metropolitan Police tweeted, "We're responding to a demonstration in Parliament Square this afternoon." And, yeah, I just read that part. It was part of the tweet. So, the people of the world have had it. COVID has a 99.99x survival rate. We're finding out more that the vaccine is probably okay. It might be okay. We don't know. We're all guinea pigs on it. But we rather wouldn't be, because we were deceived about hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. People are seeing through it now. And that it is actually a good thing that President Trump got the so-called jab out there, because it totally, you know, disrupted the deep state's lockdown plans. What I think is, I don't think the shot itself is that dangerous. What's really sinister about the whole vaccination movement by the deep state is they're trying to see how far they can go towards violating the Nuremberg Code. People should not be able to should not be forced to put anything in their bodies that they don't consent to, and unless it's been scientifically proven to be advantageous, and we don't know that about the vaccine yet. It was never, you know, approved by the FDA. We're pretty much a test subject right now. Like, I was kind of arm twisted at taking the vaccine by my own family, but at least I didn't let, you know, the government do it. And I will have some information about how to handle with the side effects in future articles, or I might share that on my Facebook page. But I will let you go now. Remember, the powers that be, they have some place by way of putting us in debt and by some psychological manipulation. So pay attention to all the psychological channels on YouTube and podcasts. Note how propaganda uses humiliation tactics rather than, you know, actual convincing use of logic and evidence. And with that, I will let you go. I hope you have a good one, and power to the people.